Hey guys, welcome back to Past Gas. This week we're starting off our three-part history on Porsche. We're talking about Ferdinand Porsche's early life and lasting legacy. This dude wired his house at age 16. He invented the first all-wheel drive car, the first hub motor that people still use in e-bikes and stuff today. He invented one of the first hybrids. He also designed a lot of stuff for the Nazis. So, mixed bag. It's going to be an interesting one. Let's do it. Porsche, part one. Nestled in a valley in southwest Germany lies a city that has earned a right to stake its claim as the most important center in all of automotive history. For 75 years, factories in Stuttgart have made some of the most iconic sports cars of all time. Any of these sports cars produced here over the last 7.5 decades is instantly recognizable. Circular headlights, soft body lines, and an engine pressing down on the rear wheels. We are, of course, talking about Porsche. And though Porsche has constantly pushed against the boundaries of what was possible, it's done so while holding steadfast to tradition. It's doubled down on the rear engine layout when mid-engine has proven to be better balanced, and they even used air-cooled engines into the 1990s. But how exactly has Porsche managed to change the automotive industry so much while seeming to change so little about themselves? How did they become one of the most iconic and important automakers of all time? And how did it all begin? Today on Past Gas, it's part one of our three-part history on Porsche. Hello and welcome back to Past Gas, everybody. My name is Nolan Sykes. Joining me across the table is Bart Bidlingmeyer.
Hey, happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome, Bart. And of course, to my left, it's Joe Weber. What's up, dude?
What's up, Wink Wink Nation? How's it hanging?
It's hanging fine. Thanks for asking.
You don't have to answer the question.
Rhetorical.
How it's hanging.
I'm
just saying, great.
Hey, he asked.
All's good.
All is good.
You don't start with it's hanging.
That's fair. Yeah.
I'm hanging with you guys.
Yes, you are.
That's a good catchphrase.
Yeah.
I'm hanging with you guys.
It makes it feel like everyone watching is our homie, right?
Yes, yes.
Hey, we're all just hanging together in the garage talking about P cars today, right?
That's right, P cars. It's Porsche. We're starting a nice little series here for you.
How many parts is this, Nolan?
It's three parts. Yeah. Trey.
Could have been eight. But
I'm glad it's not eight.
But HBO Max wouldn't give us the rest of the episodes.
So yeah, because Pedro Pascal has to go back at some point.
Yeah.
So he's going to do all of our reenactments for Ferdinand Porsche.
Yes.
I saw a video on Instagram of this guy who was at a car meet, and he was like, "What the hell is this?" It was like a GT3 RS, but not really. And it said 986 GT3 RS on the side. And it was someone had converted a Boxster into like a GT3 RS with a body kit. Yeah. And it looked really good and convincing, but still, like, you know, it has the Boxster engine in it. And they looked inside and it was just like the early 2000s, like Boxster interior, like kind of nasty.
All that work. And there's coffee stains and like
at least a $10,000 body kit job.
Bart, have you ever driven a Porsche?
No.
Uh-oh, we got to revoke your man card.
What about you, Joe?
I drove a Gunther Works.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Which was sick. So that was really fun.
Yeah, that thing was gnarly.
Yeah. How about you?
Driven a few of them. My favorite being the Dakar 911.
Oh, yeah. Did you drive it on ice?
Drive it on around in the snow in Quebec. That was really cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
An ice castle or no?
We did go to an ice hotel for a little bit. Check that out. I wouldn't want to stay in one of those things. They're really impractical. It's not like you can just throw your shoes and your clothes on the floor, you know, when you're like going to bed. You have to like
just go to a Westin.
Yeah, I'd rather go to the Westin.
We're not sponsored by Westin.
Westin and the boys. Eastern girls and the Westin boys.
You're a
Westin. Westin boy.
That's you. That's me. That's me. Okay. I think we should just start a story. How about that? Okay. Here we go.
People are going to timestamp it in the comments. Story starts at 7:12.
That'd be amazing if that was the actual time. Here we go. The story of
Porsche. Wait, we got to get more commercials in first because people like those.
The story of Porsche begins with its namesake, Ferdinand Porsche. He was born on September 3rd, 1875, in Maffersdorf, Bohemia, in the Austro-Hungarian Empire, which is present-day Czechia, or the Czech Republic, as it's known here in America.
Because we need different words for everything.
We do call everything different. For someone destined to have a huge impact on the automotive world, the bulk of his childhood was devoid of cars entirely. The first automobile wasn't even invented until Ferdinand was 11 years old, and it was years later before cars became common sights on the road.
He's like seven, and he's like, yeah, I really like cars. People are like, what?
Yeah.
You'll see.
You'll see.
Give me 4 years.
But from the outset, Ferdinand was interested in engineering. He was particularly fascinated by electricity, and was a bit of a wonder kid out in the field.
Wunderkind.
At age 13, he installed electric doorbells at his parents' house. 3 years later, he wired the entire house, making the Porsches the first family in Maffersdorf to have electric lighting.
And he was how old?
He was 16 when he did that, so, yeah.
I don't know if I'd trust a 16-year-old wire my house.
Yeah, but you're like, what's electricity at this point? We don't even know.
It's just electrons moving, dude. That's all it is.
Did you ever hear the story of Edison, how he would go around
blowing up elephants?
Yeah, he was a big proponent of direct current.
Mm-hmm.
And it, you know, for like a whole city grid, that's not very efficient because it's just like full blast electricity all the time. You needed really thick, like the copper wiring in New York. Back in the day, it was like this thick, and it would get really hot, and it would burn up a lot.
In a direct current, it's like a river, and people take water out of it. So by the time you get to the end of the river of a direct current circuit, there's no electricity left.
So while alternating current, I think Tesla was like on the forefront of alternating current. Edison would go around with animals, electrifying them and like killing them, to show how dangerous alternating current was and promote direct current, which was inferior.
Hey, that's, you know, marketing is all about telling a story and showmanship.
Yeah.
And that sure is showmanship. Okay. Despite Ferdinand's obvious talents and passions, his father, Anton Porsche, considered this whole electricity business to be nonsense and wanted his son to take over the family plumbing business. When his older brother, who was also named Anton, was killed in an accident at the family's workshop, Ferdinand put his passion for electricity aside to help take care of his family.
It's like, you're not going to be an electrician. You're going to be a plumber. And like, it's like, what is the difference, Dad?
Yeah, yeah, it's basically like
we're both working with our hands.
Yeah.
You know? Wasn't going to knock down the drywall.
This electricity is too dangerous. And then his brother dies at the shop. How does that happen? How do you die to plumbing?
He got flushed down the toilet.
Ferdinand completed an apprenticeship in plumbing while working for his father. He worked in the family business for several years, but his sights were still set on working as an electrician. Although he never received a degree, he took electrical engineering classes at the Imperial Technical School in Reichenberg, which is present-day Liberec. He took classes at this university to improve his electrician skills in the evenings after the family business closed for the day. Finally, when he was 18, he got his chance to leave his plumbing career for one in electricity, and he took it. Now, the sources are unclear on the particulars, but Ferdinand was able to get a referral to the Bella Egger Electrical Company in Vienna. Bella offered him a job, and thanks to his natural talent and passion, he quickly made a name for himself. Within just a few years, he worked his way up to managing the company's testing center by the mid-1890s.
Just testing electricity.
Yeah, he's like, that hurts.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, it's good. That's still good hurts. Electricity.
Still hurts. Around this time, cars were still rare sights, but interest in them was growing rapidly. For Ferdinand Porsche, cars were a revelation. He saw in them the potential to change how people lived. It was new and exciting. He was falling in love with a brand new technology all over again. It was only fitting that he set out to combine his first love, electricity, with his newest passion. Where do you think that's going?
Headlights.
Perhaps. Yeah, the Venn diagram of cars and electricity. Headlights is right in the middle. I think they should be round.
In 1897, a 22-year-old Ferdinand Porsche got a job working in the newly established automobile department of Hofwagenfabrik Jacob Lohner and Company in Vienna. There, he took over the design and building processes, and barely just a year later, on June 26, 1898, a vehicle designed by Porsche hit the road for the first time, and it was electric.
Boogie, woogie, woogie.
The car was called the P1, and as most cars of the day did, it more closely resembled a horse carriage than it did a car. Its electric drive was surprisingly compact. It weighed in at just under 300 pounds and made a staggering 3 horsepower. The car also featured a sophisticated, for its time, 12-speed gearbox that had a, quote, overloading mode, which could temporarily handle bursts of up to 5 horsepower and propel the car to a top speed of 22 miles per. The P1 made its official debut at the International Motor Vehicle Exhibition in Berlin on September 28, 1899. At the exhibition, a 40-kilometer or roughly 25-mile race was organized for the electric vehicles at the show to showcase their capabilities.
It's crazy that there were multiple electric vehicles,
right?
During that era, it was neck and neck between battery-powered and ICE engines. And then just you could only do so much with the battery, and then it just...
Yeah.
People are like, yep, gasoline forever.
Yeah, the shirt. Sky is too clean. Let's do something about that.
With 3 passengers aboard and Ferdinand Porsche at the wheel, the first Porsche ever made won the first race a Porsche ever entered.
Hell yeah.
I also love those early races, like, because we just talked about it. It's like, yeah, you can get 22 miles an hour. Like, that's the...
A brisk...
you know, yeah. We won a race.
Yeah, 22 miles an hour. Giant wooden wheels. It probably was pretty sketchy, yeah. You know?
Yeah. The brakes are probably just like hand levers that
you gotta stick your feet.
Like
out
imagine,
the car.
Imagine like that's a school zone almost.
Yeah,
you know what I mean. Like, slow down,
death-defying stunts.
Hold on, let me put on my goggles because we're gonna go 22
so fast.
It would be hard to die in a car crash, unless you really like flip the car over on yourself.
Dude. Yeah, they didn't have seatbelts. You fly out of it in a crash.
You get a wooden spoke.
A spoke goes through your sternum.
Oh, God.
Yeah. Noah and I talk about this a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. Drawing some t-shirts. Yeah, yeah. It's going to look gnarly.
Your jeans get caught in the brake.
Mm-hmm.
And you get fed into the wheel.
Since Ferdinand began working at Lohner, he had been hard at work at designing an electric hub motor that could fit inside the wheels of the car. By 1900, he had cracked it. The first car to feature the design was the Lohner Porsche Mixta, and it was revolutionary.
It's so,
cool. That is sick. That does look futuristic.
And it's so sick that they were like, we'll put your name on it, dude.
You helped.
You did such a good job.
It's going second, though.
That's what all those e-bikes that the 12-year-olds are tooling around in Redondo.
Oh, yeah.
In hub.
Dude, I was in Santa Barbara last weekend, and we were on that like walking strip, and there's just all these kids with those electric dirt bikes ripping wheelies, like almost running over you.
I don't see kids driving anymore. I just see kids on their electric motorcycles, and I saw the other day, like, this kid had his electric motorcycle with a seat on the back.
They're electric bikes. They're not motorcycles, though.
They're not bikes.
You're right. They go faster.
They're torquey.
They go like 40 miles an hour.
Yeah, they're really fast.
All right.
They're gnarly. And anyway, I saw a dude, his bike had like a seat on the back for passengers. And I was like, that's like the new version of like saying like, oh yeah, like we could take my car over to Taco Bell. It's like, no, we'll just take my bike.
Yeah.
You know? No helmets either.
I'm surprised Hollywood hasn't made like a modern rad. With the e-bikes. And there's just a bunch of teens. Like,
you get Budnick's kid in there, right? Budnick's probably got a grandkid by now.
It's been a while, yeah.
So several cars would bear the Lohner Porsche Mixta name over the years. But the first example was a chaise design. Chaise is the French word for chair, and that's basically what the car looked like. So this was the first ever car equipped with electric hub motors, technology that is still cutting edge nowadays. Later versions of this car were fitted with motors mounted inside all 4 wheels. The first design only had them in the front wheels, making it the world's first all-wheel drive car as well.
That's pretty cool.
That's pretty wild.
So it would just be like the motors inside the hub, and the part that would normally turn the axle is affixed to the axle. So that the motor itself is turning.
I think, the motor itself turns around the fixed inside of the motor.
Yeah.
The problem with that is, like, you can't, like, gear them.
Gear it.
Like it's, that's a lot of those e-bikes you see with the big fat hub.
Right.
And the, yes, they're like limited in how they can go up hills and like top speeds they can get. Whereas like the really expensive e-bikes, they do have
gearing.
Okay.
And you can get going pretty fast and also go up hills much easier and more efficiently.
It is surprising that his first iteration had a 12 speed transmission in it.
Yes, but that wasn't this hub.
That
was a different car. But yeah, you're right. That's pretty crazy too. So these cars had no transmissions and could be braked by all four wheels, which was a rarity at the time, made 2.4 horsepower, and they had a rechargeable battery with a range of about 30 miles. An impressive feat for a primitive technology hauling 2,657 pounds.
What do you think the range anxiety
is? Well, if you're in a city, like it's not like you would have to go across town. They didn't have like sprawling metropolises. You just go, kink, kink. Like LA, you know, where you had, I've got to drive over to Hollywood today and back, or I guess from here it'd be like,
but like, where would you get your, like, does it, not everybody had the electricity.
And it's probably inconsistent for voltage too.
Well, I remember reading that there was a lot of like street side chargers.
And this is Vienna,
really?
Right?
Wow.
Back in the day. Yeah.
So you go to the opera.
Yeah.
And then you charge at the opera and then you drive to another place. I don't only know one place in Vienna.
Mm-hmm. The other opera.
The other opera house.
The other opera. Yeah. Probably like a museum. It's like a very culture-filled day.
Maybe the ballet.
Ballet. And then go get one of those huge beers that's like...
A stein?
Yeah.
Or a boot?
No, a stein.
A large stein.
And then...
Down at the Biergarten.
And then go get paints because you're a painter or something? I don't know.
But yeah, but you could charge it anywhere.
Yeah.
So
that's my point.
This technology was so advanced for its time that Porsche's own history site notes the car's construction principles were used on NASA's lunar rover 70 years later. That's the other thing, too. Only 70 years between this and us going to the moon with a car.
Yeah.
And then you think about what have we done in the last 70 years?
We have amazing AI technology, Bart, that can get your Google search results wrong.
Every time.
That's what we've got. Yeah.
Every time, though.
It's great. You can also make fake pictures of your dead pets.
What the hell?
It's great technology.
Bro, you got to get out of the house.
I've been out. Been out in the fucking ether, man. With my dead pets.
Oh, my God. I have a
pet cemetery I've set up behind the office.
There's a really fun filter going where you can run a video through some AI filter, and it turns people into like pretty realistic babies.
Yeah,
right.
Have you seen it?
See, this is. Why do we need to go to Mars? Why do we need to go to the moon? Or
things
explore
are great.
The
cosmos?
I retract my earlier cynical statement.
Exactly, dude.
We're here.
We have everything we need right down here with our AI.
Okay,
we live in a society.
Thanks, Grok.
We live in a society. Okay. At the time, an arms race for the future of car propulsion was happening between the internal combustion engines and electric motors. In the early 20th century, it was beginning to become clear that internal combustion engine technology was developing more rapidly than electric, and Ferdinand realized he needed to make a change. But he wasn't ready to let go of his passion for electricity just yet. And instead of switching to ICE power on its own right away, he developed the world's first electric gas hybrid car instead. It was launched in 1901 as an addition to the Lohner Porsche Mixta line known as the Semper Vivus, Latin for always alive or always living.
Mm.
Whoa.
See, that's he's tackling that range anxiety.
And even though
it's the same thing.
That's sick, dude. Even though it carried the same name as its predecessor, it couldn't have been more different. It was lower and longer than the all-electric Chase version. It had an electric hub motor on both front wheels and a gas engine in the middle of the car and a rear bench seat out at the back. Over the next several years, Ferdinand continued to develop hybrid and electric cars for Lohner. He also began testing his designs in races, claiming several victories at the nearby Semmering circuit outside of Vienna. In 1903, Ferdinand married Aloysia Johanna Caius. A year later, his daughter Louise was born, and in 1909, his son Ferry was born.
Wow, they didn't waste any time, am I right?
The worst high five I've ever seen.
Kind of bent my finger back with your wrist.
It's a workplace accident, man. In 1906, age 31, Ferdinand left Lohner to join Austro Daimler, the Austrian branch of Daimler, as technical director. In just a year, he became the general director. He would work there for 17 years. All the while, Ferdinand's interest in racing continued to grow. And in 1910, he helped change motorsport design forever. Aerodynamics were not well understood at this time, but engineers recognized it as a concept, and Ferdinand was the first to implement the theory into car design. With the technology and information available back then, making something as aerodynamic as possible was little more than guesswork. But Ferdinand tried it anyway, and he got pretty dang close. The result was the Austro Daimler 2780, which looks not very aerodynamic, if I have to say so. But
the only thing I can tell is that
it fans out. From
A tulip.
Like a tulip?
You know, it like opens like a tulip.
You know, the way the flowers come up and out. Yeah. That's how the cockpit.
I just realized I don't really know what a tulip looks like.
This long and narrow saloon car featured a rounded off grille and a curved body that angled away from the passengers and tapered to a small edge. The science wasn't quite there yet, but Ferdinand's movement away from the conventional tall and boxy silhouettes of the early 1900s to a more air-friendly, curvaceous design was a major step forward in the application of aerodynamics. The car's first proving ground was a race called the Prinz Heinrich Fahrt, or Prince Henry Tour.
Fart.
When we were at the Volkswagen factory,
it was very quiet and you farted.
No, but this little test course we had at this factory was called like the Ausfart.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And that was funny.
In Ausfart. Swedish, fart means speed. I think it's different in German. It might be like coarser. I don't know, something. But so the Keanu Reeves movie is just fart.
That's pretty hilarious.
Yeah.
Nice.
That's fake news.
I got to get a physical copy of that for my collection. So this Prinz Heinrich Fahrt was a long-distance test for touring cars, as these types of non-race cars were known in the days before actual production cars. The tour took drivers on a six-day, 1,208-mile journey across German-speaking Europe, making a loop that passed through cities such as Berlin, Nuremberg, Stuttgart, Strasbourg, which is in modern-day France, and Hamburg. And out of the 37 cars that started the race on June 8, 1910, Ferdinand's 2780 was the first to cross the finish line.
We'll be right back after these messages. Now, back to the show.
As it often goes in these stories, though, the outbreak of World War I changed everything. The start of the war hit particularly close to home for Ferdinand.
Yeah, they started it.
As a reserve soldier in the Austro-Hungarian military in 1902, Ferdinand Porsche was assigned as a driver to the Archduke and heir to the throne of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, one Franz Ferdinand.
That's crazy.
Take me out.
Was he there when he got popped?
I don't think so. But I mean, that would have meant crazy. That he knew the guy and drove the guy around.
No, this was years before he got killed.
But he was assigned to be his driver.
Yes, in 1902. Saying,
like, how long was he his driver?
Yeah, enough to like get to know him, I think.
The Archduke was assassinated 12 years later in 1914, and the event is considered the catalyst that set off World War I. Having personally known the man whose murder sent the entire world to war must have shaken Ferdinand to his core. But he had little time to process the shock. His country was rapidly mobilizing, and as a respected engineer in command of one of the largest design and manufacturing companies in the country, he was thrust into a pivotal role in the war effort. Throughout the war, Ferdinand directed Austro Daimler's production of trucks and the Landwehr train, a truck that could travel on roads and train tracks.
Cool.
Could do both. Car development was put on an indefinite hold, and Ferdinand's engineering skills were put to use for the army as well. While at Daimler, he had designed aircraft engines since at least 1910. During the war, he designed a few himself, which were manufactured at Austro Daimler. The engines produced here became some of the most well-known engines to come out of the war thanks to their high output and their ability to produce power at low RPM. Ferdinand's first wartime engine was an inline six capable of 120 horsepower, but war spurred on a rapid sequence of innovations. And by 1917, Ferdinand had developed a inline six capable of 225 horsepower at 1400 RPM. It's pretty amazing, actually.
Yeah, that's great.
And later, two V12s based on the inline six's design that made 300 horsepower at just 1250 RPM.
What the hell?
And 345 horsepower at 1350 RPM. How is that even possible? The engines
That's only 100 RPM difference.
Yeah,
it's and wild. It bumps up like a 75 horsepower?
45. Still very good, though. The engines were so good, in fact, that the Technical University of Vienna gave him an honorary doctorate in recognition of the designs. And from then on, he was known as Dr. Ferdinand Porsche.
It's kind of like how Alex Jones gave Jordan Peterson his doctorate for being sick as hell. Right? You remember that episode? No.
I watched so much, they all blend together.
That's it. That is kind of funny, though. You get like an honorary doctorate and you're like, I actually am a doctor. I'm just running with it. That's pretty shameless.
And you get to do surgeries and stuff.
Yeah.
Well, if like he probably knows more than the university does
in this field, for sure. Yeah.
Maybe that's a way for them to get him to like
share knowledge, perhaps.
Yeah. Like write the curriculum or something.
Yeah.
No, he just gave a speech at commencement and. They said, thanks.
Yeah. Rev your engines. Your life is just starting now.
That's a really good
really?
Commencement. Yeah.
That's a great speech, dude. That got me fired up. We just had a guy from we had a guy from like CNBC at my commencement.
A producer from CNBC.
Literally. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
A producer.
Yeah. We did.
Congrats.
Yeah. Austria-Hungary was devastated after the war. As part of the Central Powers alongside Germany and the Ottoman Empire, they had been on the losing side and forced to pay reparations. The empire, which had been established a few years before Ferdinand was born, was dissolved. As a resident of Vienna, he found himself part of a newly independent Austria. His hometown of Mafersdorf was now in a different country, Czechoslovakia, a fact that must have made his post-war reality difficult to grapple with.
It's a weird, the history of that region is weird and how.
Pretty fascinating.
The Czech people and the Slovakian people don't get along very well historically. And then they're just like, you guys are kind of the same.
You guys are a country now.
And it's like, okay, great.
The first few years after the war were particularly difficult. Gas was still being rationed and inflation was rising. Luxury items like cars, which were still nowhere as commonplace in society as they are now, were pretty far down the line on people's lists of needs. As some of you might remember from our four-parter on Mercedes, Austro-Daimler's parent company, DMG, even had to resort to printing its own money during this era. Car sales slowed to a trickle, and so did design needs. But in 1922, Ferdinand was tasked with building his first bespoke race car for an Austrian count named Sascha Kolarot.
He's a vampire.
Sounds very vampiric.
Sacha Baron Cholerat.
Ferdinand designed a small car known as the Austro-Daimler Sascha. The Sascha was tiny. The driver practically sat on top of the rear axle, and the length of the car in front of the driver was the room needed to fit the controls in the axle and no more. Very cool.
I'd be scared to sit above the axle just in case, like, a stone pops through, hits you in the bum. There's a rally video where they're going over gravel and you see the co-driver go like, oh, and Stone had shot through the bottom of the floor pan and then like through his seat and like his butt.
Ow.
Yeah.
So the Sascha had a 1.1 liter four cylinder that made an impressive 50 horsepower. And with a curb weight of just over
1 liter?
1.1.
Jeez.
And with a curb weight of just over 1,300 pounds, the Sascha topped out at around 90 miles per hour.
What?
Ferdinand built two of these cars, and they were entered in the 1922 Targa Florio, the world's premier endurance race of the time.
Now Jay Leno takes it to Bob's Big Boy every Saturday.
They scored a 1-2 class victory against cars with much larger engines, including a 4.2 liter Alfa Romeo ES, piloted by the one and only Antonio Ascari. If you want to know more about the legendary Ascari Racing Family, check out episode 197. We've talked all about these guys.
That was 100 episodes ago.
Oh boy.
The machine never fills up. We got to keep feeding it.
I'm so tired. Okay. Following the success of the Sascha, Ferdinand moved to Stuttgart to take on a new role as technical director of Daimler. There, he continued to build high-performance cars for the brand, like the S, the SS, and the SSK. Daimler merged with Benz to create Mercedes-Benz in 1926. Ferdinand continued to work for the merged version of the company, designing truck and aircraft engines until 1929, when he moved back to Austria to work as general director of Steyr. His time with Steyr was short-lived. Steyr is a really interesting company. Have we talked about that?
Steyr Puch?
They build the G-Wagon.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, and, so they're like a military arm or what?
Well, no, they're like a general, they do a lot of like contract work, but they built the Supra. The Mark V Supra was built by Steyr.
What?
The G-Wagon. Yeah, like they will build cars under contract for other companies.
Whoa.
They're like a independent factory of sorts.
Okay. The only thing I know them from is the little mopeds, the Steyr Puchs.
They do all that. They built guns, the Steyr AUG, the little
sick-ass
polymer
It's got a
rifle.
Funky shape, right?
Very funky shape.
Yeah.
I would love one of those. If you know how to get one legally in California.
God, dude,
please
stop.
Please let me know.
Or illegally, just don't tell
dude, anybody. But when in that one song, what is it? It's on 2001, Toten Austrian Firearms that is made out of plastic. That's what they're talking about, is that?
Oh, damn.
One of those and Glocks. Glocks are plastic as well.
Glocks are plastic?
Not the slide. The slide is metal. The barrel's metal.
Stuff?
But the, I forget what they're called. Yeah. The body, the chassis maybe is what, I don't know. Like the hand part that you hold on to is a polymer. Yeah. Anyway, this is not a gun show. We're not that show.
Do I want to be it?
Yeah. Toten Austrian Firearms made out of plastic. Okay.
What song is that?
Let me Google.
I think it's Party in the USA.
I think it's Explosive, I think.
I went on like a ski trip thing, and I was like, guys, I made a mix for the trip. I put it in, and it was Party in the USA, and they're like, that's pretty funny.
Oh, Lightspeed.
It was 12 Party in the USA songs back.
Oh, my God.
Ferdinand's time at Steyr was short-lived. In 1931, at 55 years old, Ferdinand had over 30 years of experience in the auto industry. He had worked for some of the biggest names and created some of the best cars in the business. Now, he decided, it was time to see what he could do on his own.
That's crazy. 1931 to have 30 years experience in the
automotive industry?
Yeah,
wild.
Yeah.
You know,
from day one.
Yeah.
I heard that there's a conspiracy theory in China that Western history is like fake because they don't believe that like the statues and stuff from like the Hellenic era in Greece mm-hmm. are like they're too good. Like, people from that time could not have made.
They're like, look at our
precise.
Our.
What about the terracotta?
That's what I mean. Like, they're like, look at our terracotta statues.
Yeah, they're great. So those are just as
and
like,
our lions.
Detailed.
Yeah, but no, because they don't have. When you get to the Hellenic era, you have different. You can see elements of nature. You can see wind blowing. In Nicaea Samothrace. You can see multiple elements of realism
so
that you couldn't see.
But
in
when
other
is
cultures
Hellenic?
At the time.
Is that still BC or no?
Yeah, it's Greece.
One, it's very affirming to know that people all over the world have dumb theories about everything. But also, like, I think this time in history of car history gets kind of like minimized because one, we're pretty far removed. We're almost 100 years removed from it. But like, we think that they were such rudimentary people that we don't realize how advanced their technology was for the time. And yeah, like, oh yeah, 30 years of auto experience in 1930. It sounds like so foreign that it sounds like unbelievable. Yeah.
Well, there's a basketball player in OKC that doesn't believe anything happened before 1950.
Is it Tyler Herro? No.
Yeah.
Oh, it is. Okay.
Yeah. And he was like, yeah, that's why I don't believe in the moon landing. They were like, that happened after 1950.
That's like you're like so stupid that your stupidity actually makes you sound even stupider.
Yeah.
That's hard to do.
I know. Yeah.
That's hilarious.
Have you heard the interview with Meta World Peace where he talks about changing his name to Meta World Peace?
No.
He's like, he's talking to Phil Jackson. He's like, I could be anybody I want to be, you know, like kind of in like getting in this realm and exploring. And he changed his name to Metal World Peace. And then he heard it announced and he just thought, why did I do that?
So on January 1st of 1931, Porsche signed a rental agreement for an office and workshop in Stuttgart. And on April 25th, he registered Porsche LLC, design and consultancy company for engine and vehicle production, or as we know it, Porsche. Early Porsche made a lot of stuff, including wind turbines, engines, and suspensions. They even designed vehicles for other manufacturers like Wanderer and Zündapp. Later that year, Ferdinand developed a revolutionary torsion bar suspension, the first torsion bar suspension system, which is pretty cool.
Pretty wild.
Yeah. So let's do a recap. First in-hub electric motor.
First all-wheel drive
first
car.
First all-wheel drive
first
car.
First hybrid.
First torsion. Yeah, first hybrid and first torsion bar suspension. That's sick.
Yeah, yeah. The first Austrian house with electricity.
Yeah. Yeah.
There you go.
First imagine trying to sell that house. Where you're like, and the electric.
Oh, it'd go for $3 million in West LA. Yeah. That's,
we're just like,
you just got to rewire it.
Yeah. Trying to bury the fact that a 16-year-old wired the whole house.
I don't know that you had code then.
Yeah.
Well, at that time, too, that'd be like saying like a 50-year-old man wired this house.
Yeah. Because people only lived to 27.
Yeah. Porsche quickly made a name for itself, but a dark era of the company was about to begin.
Yeah. Water-cooled engines.
Porsche's early...
V6s in the front.
We'll be right back after these messages. Now, back to the show.
Porsche's early successes, and by extension, Ferdinand's early successes, started to attract attention from a lot of people, including bloodthirsty dictators. In 1932, Joseph Stalin invited Ferdinand to visit the Soviet Union. The Soviet. They like to cook.
Let them cook.
In 1932, Joseph Stalin invited Ferdinand to visit the Soviet Union. Stalin was so impressed with Ferdinand's work that he wanted to make him head of the USSR's automotive industry. Ferdinand was taken around the country to visit various plants that made everything from cars to airplanes. Stalin even offered Ferdinand a villa and to pay to transfer his entire staff from Stuttgart. Ferdinand ultimately declined, citing the language barrier and a lack of racing infrastructure in the Soviet Union. Back in Germany, Ferdinand had his sights set on racing. Grand Prix racing, a predecessor to Formula One, had reduced its weight regulations from 900 to 750 kilograms for the 1933 season, and Ferdinand wanted to design a car that would dominate it.
How much is 750?
That is 1,600 pounds.
Oh, that's light.
Pretty light.
Is that like eight Nolans?
Yes. Less than eight Nolans. Yeah. At the time, money was flowing into the German racing industry from the Nazi Party, which had assumed power earlier that year and had granted Adolf Hitler dictatorial powers. Hitler, as you might remember from our four-parter on Mercedes, wanted to showcase German dominance in motorsport, which led to the Mercedes Silver Arrows. Auto Union was granted funds from Hitler and the Nazis as well, and Ferdinand Porsche used those funds to set about designing one of the most dominant race cars of all time, the Auto Union 16-cylinder. The supercharged 4.4-liter V16 produced 290 horsepower at 4,500 RPM and 391 foot-pounds at 2,700 RPM.
So each cylinder was like a third of a liter? That's really small. Huh.
Pretty small. Yeah, it's. I mean, this is like a... be like a... this is like the V8 size. 12.
Yeah, 4.4-liter, but it's 16 cylinders.
Yes.
Yeah.
So pretty small bore. Those massive torque numbers meant a huge advantage over its high-revving, low-torque rivals. Haggerty notes that its torque curve was, quote, a flat table, and that at small technical courses like Monaco, the 16-cylinder engine didn't even need to change gears. It won half of the 64 races it entered throughout the 1930s. Unfortunately, though, this marked the beginning of years of collaboration between Ferdinand and the Nazis. In June 1934, Ferdinand was commissioned to build a car that would be accessible to all people in the German Reich and bring automobile transit to the masses. The project was dubbed Volkswagen, or People's Car, which laid the foundation for both the VW company and their first car, the Beetle. So there are dozens of photos of Ferdinand hanging out with Adolf Hitler and other Nazi bosses like Joseph Goebbels from the 1930s. His relationship with Nazi leaders was so good that during an era when the Nazis were looking for any reason to call someone un-German or impure and imprison or deport them, Ferdinand, a Czechoslovakian, was made a naturalized German citizen. Afterwards, he officially joined the Nazi Party and was made managing director of technology and planning for the German Reich. Now
he might be Czech, but he's a good one.
Yeah, very useful for them. So with the Beetle, he kind of like stole the design of the Beetle from a company called Tatra.
He borrowed heavily.
Well, sure. Yeah. I mean, you look
at
this. It's not quite.
But also the
Tatra has three headlights.
And the Tatra had its back end would
very swoopy.
Yes.
Yeah.
Tatra was a Czechoslovakian company, and the founder of Tatra actually was also, he was also Jewish. So, you know, it's not a huge leap of the imagination that at the time, Porsche was like, felt empowered to just like steal from this guy.
Yeah. There's a wonderful museum, and I'm forgetting the name, in Nashville, a car museum, and the guy has so many Tatras. It's pretty amazing. They're all great. They're amazing looking cars. He's even got like a 16-wheel Tatra truck, like hauler. In anyways,
let us know in the comments if you want us to do an episode just on Tatra, because I'm getting pretty intrigued.
They're pretty amazing. Like, they were making horsepower unlike anybody else.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh shit.
Out of air cooled engines and the aerodynamics, like they pioneered it. And it's a Czech company that, like, you're like, what? How do we not know?
So we didn't check.
Yeah. They made a lot of engines. So that's why when something's wrong with your engine, they say that, yeah, it's the Czech engine light goes
on. Oh, that makes sense. I always wondered what that meant.
And that's actually the outline that you see. That's the Czech country.
That's so interesting.
Yeah.
Because it does. I was like, what country is that? Now it's all just like,
it's the borders have moved since. That's why you can't recognize it now. But that's why we get that Czech engine light in that shape.
In 1936, Ferdinand traveled to the United States to meet with one Henry Ford, who himself was also a Nazi sympathizer, to study mass production for the future Volkswagen plant. The Wolfsburg factory broke ground in May of 1938, and Germans had begun sending in money to a, quote, savings scheme that effectively allowed consumers to pre-order a car and begin making payments on it. These consumers would never get their cars, though.
I know another fascist sympathizer who uses that automotive model.
No, that's good.
As World War II began before the factory was ready to produce them for consumer purchase. Instead, they were only made for high-ranking party officials before production retooled to make wartime vehicles. I've been to the Wolfsburg factory.
And you horked down one of the sausages there.
I had one of the sausages, currywurst. But yeah, there are like during the factory tour, they like show you there's like beams, metal, like steel beams of the factory with like bullet holes in them from Allied
getting strafed.
Yeah.
Strafed.
Bombed the factory, the Allies.
From getting strafed.
Yeah.
You don't look so good in this episode.
Ow! And there's still like, there's like Nazi eagle regalia around the building, like in the concrete, but they've like swastikas have been like chiseled out and stuff. Mm-hmm. There are,
that happened when they stored the Ark of the Covenant in there and it got rid of all the Nazi symbols.
Yeah, there's like eagles and there's like a few different like, you know, working quote stuff, you know, on the building. Yeah. Nothing like
sets you free.
Not like that. No. But yeah, you know, it's like they're not obviously not proud of it, but like they still acknowledge, they're like, yeah, man, like the Nazis built this place and they still use it. It's like their headquarters, you know.
Yeah.
It's crazy. Before the war consumed Ferdinand and his factories, he completed work on two very important cars. The first was the Mercedes Porsche T80. It's quite possibly the most advanced car ever made at the time, and certainly would have been the fastest had it actually been given a chance to do what it had been designed to do, break the land speed record. The specs were truly unbelievable for 1939. The car was a culmination of everything Ferdinand had learned in his now 40-year-long career making cars. The car itself weighed around 6,000 pounds, mostly thanks to its 44.5-liter V12. It was the same engine used in some Luftwaffe aircraft. The engine was designed to be run upside down, so the crank was upside and the cylinder heads were down, and made 3,000 horsepower.
Holy shit.
It couldn't achieve those numbers on gasoline alone, though. It was tuned to run on a mix of seven different chemicals that included methanol, ethanol, benzene, acetone,
nitrobenzene,
AV gas, and ether.
Wow.
That's nuts.
Dude, don't get this guy near that
engine. What is the advantage of running an engine upside down?
I don't know.
I'm trying to think of the physics of the piston heads.
I think for a plane, having the center of, like, the crankshaft would be at the top. So the center of mass would be lower and kind of hang on the plane.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know.
For a car. Yeah. Let us know in the comments, any of you engine.
Plane heads.
Yeah.
Let us know.
Or even car heads. Even engine. Yeah, just engines in general.
There's someone out there who plays far too much War Thunder who knows why this was run upside down. And if that's you, let us know down in the comments. I know you're out there. The car in question was 27 feet long and had six wheels thanks to its use of a double rear axle. Aerodynamic design had come a long way since the bathtub-looking Austro Daimler 2780 from 1910, as the T80 had a drag coefficient of just 0.18. Damn. Which is even lower than the lowest production car's drag coefficient in 2025. The goal top speed was 750 kilometers per hour or 466. And the planned site wasn't the wide open salt flats of Bonneville, but rather a stretch of the newly built Autobahn that measured just 90 feet wide. The test date was set for the dead of winter and would have probably ended in disaster, as the current top speed record for a piston powered car is 409 miles per hour. Fortunately for driver Hans Stuck, the test was canceled after the outbreak of the war. More importantly to the history of Porsche was the Type 64 race car, which is considered the grandfather of all the cars that wear the Porsche badge. Here's what that looks like.
Wow.
That's neat.
That's like a Mars Attacks car.
Yeah. The Type 64 was designed to compete in another event that was eventually canceled because of the war. It was a race from Berlin to Rome. It was based on the heavily modified Beetle platform. It weighed just over 1,300 pounds and made 95 horsepower from a rear-mounted flat four.
I bet that's fun.
I also like the idea that they're like, oh, we should go from Berlin to Rome because, like, we get along with Italy. And
yeah, they're fascist.
Like, we get, and then it's like, oh, but we're at war with everyone in between.
Yeah, I always wonder, like, as this shit is going on, just being part of the race division during the war, being like, yeah, I think we can probably hit 460.
Yeah. Well, it's the ramp up to war. You're right.
The Type 64 was the first car that looked like Porsche as we know them today. And with its rear mounted flat engine, the recipe had been formulated. But as we mentioned before, World War II brought all of this to a halt. As managing director of technology and planning, Ferdinand designed and directed the production of German war vehicles like the Kubelwagen and the Schwimmwagen, basically a German Jeep and its amphibious counterpart. He was also involved in the production of the, quote, elephant gun, the Panzer VIII tank, and the V1 flying bomb. Ferdinand's membership in the Nazi Party and his enthusiastic collaboration with its leadership is without a doubt a very visible stain on Porsche's history. And whatever selfish motivations Ferdinand may have had to take that path, his ideas and designs helped in a pretty sizable way to enable a cruel regime to wage war. Those persecuted within Germany's own borders, something Ferdinand would have been aware of, were then used as slave labor in factories that Ferdinand operated and resulted in needless and tragic loss of life.
Yeah, I don't think there's any like separating.
There isn't.
This company from what they did.
I remember when we talked about Enzo Ferrari years ago. I mean, he palled around with the Italian fascists at the time. He was like at these like fascist get-togethers at these big mansions that they all had. Like these guys.
I mean, not just Ferrari. The dudes at Alfa Romeo, Fiat, which is why all of their factories got bombed as well.
Mm-hmm. The war came to an end in 1945, but Ferdinand, like many high-ranking German engineers from the war, would find his path back to a peacetime existence wasn't going to be straightforward. In December of 1945, he and his son, Ferry, were arrested by French forces and jailed in French-occupied Germany. The horrors of World War II and the stain of their collaboration would leave marks on both the psyche and the reputation of the Porsche family. Their way out of prison and back into the automotive limelight would come from an unlikely place. With Ferdinand's failing health, his son Ferry would take the reins and set the Porsche name on a path to legend status and create perhaps the most famous sports car of all time, the 911. That's next time on Pass Gas, the history of Porsche, part 2.
There definitely you go. Like a big skid mark on the underpants of Porsche.
Absolutely.
Through all this. Yep. And one to keep in mind as we get into the second part. So this is the cool part. Started making.
We got through the muck and the mire, and now we're gonna
get into the real stuff.
The gas but yeah, and the I mean, fire.
Like you said, Joe, like
ow!
Okay. All right, so make sure you stick around for that. Guys, follow Bart at BidsBarto. Follow Joe at Joe G. Weber. Follow me at Nolan J. Sykes. Big thank you to the crew today. We got John, Mark, and Audrey behind the camera and the mixing board. Thank you so much, guys.
And Audrey wrote this part. And you know what? I gave her maybe like 4 notes. It was just good to go.
And thank you guys so much for listening. We will see you next week. Part 2, Porsche. Be there or I'll find you.